Well, the statistics are alarming. According to a 2010 report from the Centers for Disease Control, 26.9% of American Indian and Alaska Native women experienced an attempted or completed rape at some time in their lives. That compares to about 19% for white women. Another study unearthed by the Seattle Times showed that nearly 95% of Native women in the Seattle area were rape survivors. And a study by the U.S. Department of Justice shows murder rates among Native American women to be significantly higher than the rest of the population. It's a problem that's been underreported, and many of these cases are never even investigated. We have two guests with us this morning to tell us more. I think actually at this point we only have one of them, so we'll guess who's on the phone with us. Lisa Brunner co-directs the Indigenous Women's Human Rights Collective in Minnesota. Lisa, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. And we're also supposed to be talking with Mary Catherine Nagel, who is an attorney at Pipestem Law in Tulsa. Mary, are you with us? I guess not. We'll keep trying to reach her. So, Lisa, let's start with you. Tell us about the Indigenous Women's Human Rights Collective and what that organization does.
The Indigenous Human Rights Collective is a very new nonprofit that is being developed with my colleagues, Peggy Bird from the Santo Domingo Pueblo in New Mexico, so she's the other director, and with our board. And it's to start addressing the human rights violations that are very prevalent here in the United States against Indigenous women when it comes to looking at the statistics of the rates of violence that's being committed. You know, as some of the statistics that you just quoted, you know, when we think about the rape, you know, Native American, Alaska Native women are raped 2.5 times higher than the rest of the population of women in the country. We are stalked 2 times higher than the rest of the population of women in the country, and we're murdered up to 10 times higher than the national average of the United States of America. And when we are the, you know, as Indigenous people, we are the minority population in the country. According to the U.S. Census data, we are roughly about maybe 3 million, if that. And so we are the minority of the rest of the population here, and we have a beautiful diversity in this country. And yet the level of violence that's being targeted against Native women is far greater than anybody else. And that's a human rights issue, and we need to start looking at it in that light.
And it would appear, at least from the statistics that I could see, that Native women in urban areas and those living on reservations are equally at risk.
Oh, absolutely. A few years ago, I did an interview with El Jazeera. And so I live on the White Earth Ojibwe Nation here in Minnesota. And it was to bring about the questions of why are Native women being targeted for these rates of violence. And so if you look at the United States Department of Justice statistics for sexual assaults, for example, so like I said, we're targeted for sexual assaults 2.5 times higher than all other women. Well, 67% of those perpetrators are non-Native. Approximately 57% of that are white men. And so when the question was asked about why are we being targeted, I said, well, we're not being targeted because of the color of our skin. We're being targeted for who we are as Native women, and what we represent is our tribal nations, and we are the ones who give birth to our future generations. So this is modern-day cowboys versus Indian. And so when we think about the beautiful diversity that's here in the United States, you know, you have Mexican, Latino, Brazilian, I mean, it's just, it's so many. And if it had to do with the color of our skin, the rates of violence then would be equatable because, you know, there's beautiful brown-skinned women everywhere. But that's not why we're being targeted. We're being targeted specifically for who we are. So whether you're on a reservation and off reservation, you know, that's the intent and purpose of what my belief is why we're being targeted for these rates of violence.
Now, one of the conditions on the reservation and the fact that most of these assaults are being carried out against Native women by white men is there's kind of a strange legal loophole so that if you are not a member of a particular tribe and you commit a crime on the reservation, it's much more difficult to be prosecuted. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So in 1978, the Supreme Court passed a law called Oliphant versus Suquamish. And essentially what that Supreme Court decision stated is that tribes do not have criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians who come onto our lands and commit acts of violence against us. And so essentially what that legal loophole created was, to me, creating diplomatic immunity. If you're not, if you're non-native and you come onto our lands, our tribal law enforcement and our tribal nations essentially cannot touch you. And so that leaves that jurisdiction to the United States government. And so you have currently 573 federally recognized tribes in the country, and our jurisdictional schematic is very, very complex. So you have a majority of tribes that are in public law 280 states. So there are six mandatory states that passed in 1953. So you have Minnesota, Alaska, California, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and Oregon. So the tribes within those states were criminal jurisdiction was transferred from the federal government to the states, which created a huge complex issue in and of itself because there was no funding to support the states to respond to a now massive large land base and a whole new jurisdiction of people. And so that created massive and still creates massive jurisdictional complexities and misconceptions of what public law 280 is. And then you have other tribes that are in non-public law 280 states, which is still under federal jurisdiction, and has to do with the Major Crimes Act, which is murder, rape, and so forth. And so you have, it was the Government Accountability Office a few years back did an assessment of federal jurisdiction. So of the 573, 300 plus are in public law 280 states, 200 plus are in under federal jurisdiction in non-PL 280 states. And so the Government Accountability Office did, you know, looked at the statistics of the tribes and the federal government in non-PL 280 in their response to sexual assaults. The federal government, responsible for those crimes in Indian country, declined to prosecute up to 67% of sexual assault cases happening in Indian country. And so there isn't really much of an assessment yet for tribes in public law 280, but I can already tell you that if someone were to take that undertaking, which I hope they do, they will see, I think, similar equatable statistics about the declinations and responses to that violence.
We're talking with Lisa Brunner, who co-directs the Indigenous Women's Human Rights Collective in Minnesota. We're talking about the difficulty and the legal loopholes involved when someone commits a murder or an assault on an Indian reservation. It's a good time to bring in Mary Catherine Nagel, who joins us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. She's an attorney at Pipestem Law. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us here on the Jefferson Exchange. So Pipestem Law, do you particularly in your firm deal with Native issues?
Yeah, I would say almost exclusively. I mean, it's not specific that we wouldn't represent a non-Native person, but I think, especially at this given moment, all of our representation is of a tribal nation or a tribal citizen.
So do you have direct experience? Lisa was just telling us about all the kind of strange legal loopholes that are in effect when someone who is not Native commits a crime on an Indian reservation, such as a sexual assault or a murder. Are you directly involved in cases like that?
Yes.
And can you describe a little bit, maybe in a little bit greater detail, how some of these loopholes work?
Well, I mean, they've been created by those that make the laws, right? And most of our laws today, in terms of federal law, come from either the United States Congress, which passes legislation, or the Supreme Court, which interprets the legislation once it's been passed and signed into law by the president to say, you know, this is what this law means, or it means this or that. So anytime you have a crime being committed on a reservation, you're looking at a combination of federal laws and federal Supreme Court cases interpreting those laws to decipher who has jurisdiction over what crime. And unfortunately, as Lisa pointed out, in 1978, the United States Supreme Court stripped our tribal nations of their inherent jurisdiction to prosecute crimes that non-natives commit when they come onto our lands and commit crimes. So, you know, again, there are, you go to any law school or any law firm and ask any lawyer, anytime you have a rule, there are exceptions. And certainly in 2013, Congress restored a piece of the jurisdiction that the Supreme Court took away in 1978. But that piece is not the full restoration. It doesn't put us back to a 1977 status. So we're still working towards that full restoration. And I think that's the goal of many advocates today.
So is there a sense, I mean, the statistics are pretty clear that Native American women are being unusually targeted here in terms of sexual assault and even murder. Do you have a sense that there's kind of a widespread understanding among perpetrators that, hey, I'm probably not going to get arrested for this?
I think yes, especially on certain reservations. I mean, again, every community is different. Every tribal nation is different. Jurisdictional issues are different, you know, for some tribes in Alaska than they are going to be for in Oklahoma or South Dakota. But I know anecdotally, most definitely, talking to some tribal prosecutors in certain communities that, you know, you talk to some folks and they know, the folks on the street know, you go commit a crime as a non-native on this reservation and the tribal government can't arrest you. Now, you know, that's probably not the case everywhere. I don't know a statistic that speaks to that directly, but certainly anecdotally, that is what people are saying.
Lisa Brunner, one of the situations that I read about a lot is the Bakken area in North Dakota as being a particularly violence-prone area. Do you have any knowledge of that?
I do. So in 2013, I was asked to testify before the United States Congress in regards to the human trafficking happening of Native American, Alaska Native women. And I was asked specifically to testify regarding the Bakken oil boom area in Fort Berthold and Fort Peck area in both North Dakota and in Montana, where that land base was covered. And the advocates on the ground had shared with me that the level of violence had tripled. They did not see what was about to happen with the coming of the Bakken oil boom. And so it was, you know, you have the increase of sex trafficking of Native women and children. You have the increase of domestic violence, of course, sexual assault, stalking, and increasingly is the missing and murdered of Indigenous women. Of Native women within those territories. And so if we look throughout history, I did write an environmental justice paper to kind of, you know, piece together the issues of victimization of communities when you have an influx of, men coming into a very isolated area. And it's not to say that all pipeline workers or those working in these areas are bad. There's just enough of them in that mix that creates a threat to that community.
These are the so-called man camps.
Yep, the man camps.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, in my paper, I wrote how in the 1800s of the Alaskan gold rush and the California gold rush, it was a very eerie paradigm of looking at the mentality back then, and just the carnivorous behaviors and the attack against the Indigenous people, the Native people, by workers, you know, from the 1800s. So nothing has really changed from the mentality of the 1800s to today, other than the methodology of extraction. And make no mistake that these types of extractive industries are very predatory. When they come in and into territories, especially in tribal territories, in violation for most parts of, if you look at what happened in Standing Rock and what we're facing here for White Earth, facing Enbridge Pipeline 3, it is a very real threat that these predatory economics bring with them when it comes to protecting our people and our lands. So the violence against Mother Earth is very much equatable to the violence being committed against Native women.
We're talking this morning on the Jefferson Exchange with Lisa Brunner, who co-directs the Indigenous Women's Human Rights Collective in Minnesota. And also with us this morning is Mary Catherine Nagel, who's an attorney with Pipestem Law in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You can join the conversation this morning by calling us at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So what services, medical and social services, are available for a Native woman who's been sexually assaulted?
Well, it depends on where they're at. So if you are on our reservations, you have Indian health services, and not all Indian health services are 24-hour emergency care services or hospitals. So, for example, here on White Earth, we have Indian health services, but they're only clinics. So then we need to utilize other hospitals, or you have victims who may have to travel anywhere between 75 to 100 and some miles in order to get to the nearest medical facility for rape examinations and medical service and care. So it was Sharon Assatoyer from the Native American Women's Health Organization in Pierre, South Dakota, who actually did studies regarding what Native women face in tribal communities when seeking services for medical response to sexual assaults. And that was the determination of just, and that's just one way. That's not even round trip for victims. And then two, it's also looking at healthcare facilities that are culturally respectful and mindful, not just for us, but all other, the diversity of all of the other cultures here in this country. So whether they're on the reservation or off reservation, it just depends on the location.
Mary Catherine Nagel, we're talking not just about sexual assault here in these really alarming statistics, but murder as well. And actually, either one of you may answer this question. Do most of these murders, most of which are unsolved, also involve sexual assault?
I don't know, Lisa, if you have an answer to that. I don't know a statistic that could tell you whether it's over 50% or under 50%. I do know that it is not uncommon, unfortunately, when women are murdered and Native women are murdered, for there to be a sexual assault involved in the case.
Yeah, I would have to echo Mary Catherine as well, that there hasn't been enough response to even begin to thoroughly look at the murdered and missing Indigenous women in this country, much less the conditions in which they've been found, and whether or not they have been sexually assaulted, because it hasn't really come to light to start addressing the issues of the murdered and missing of Indigenous women in this country until the last couple of years. When you look at Senator Heidi Heitkamp, she designed and wrote the Savannah's Act, which had to do with Savannah LaFontaine Graywin, who was 22, last year had gone missing at 8 months pregnant, and her body being found 8 days later. It was a violent homicide, and her child had been womb-napped, and so the baby is fine and was with the father and whatnot. But that really prompted her to author the bill for Savannah's Act. And you have subsequent bills being drafted, like Mary Kunish Podain, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name correct, from Minnesota here, who drafted a bill for creating a task force on missing and murdered Indigenous women to start garnering at least some type of response to the issues that we're facing. And this is not a new issue. This is a very old one. This has been happening for quite some, for hundreds of years. And so it's just now coming to light to, garner a response to that.
We just have a couple of moments left here, but Mary Catherine Nagel, what legal changes need to happen to really truly address this problem?
Well, we've got multiple bills that have been proposed in Congress right now, and I think advocating for any number of them is fantastic. and lots of great bills that restore, jurisdiction. I mean, one is Savannah's Act. It doesn't restore jurisdiction, actually, but it's an important bill to address murdered and missing. There's, reauthorizations of the Violence Against Women Act that's been proposed by Sheila Jackson Lee and others, and, Tom Cole in the House, Representative Tom Cole, has a version that he's, a bill that he's just authored and sponsored. So there's a lot of pending legislation that is quite significant. None of it constitutes a full Oliphant fix, and so this is where we have this sort of separation of powers issue. You know, the Supreme Court is the branch of the federal government that allegedly took away the right of our nations to protect our women from those who seek to murder them, in their homelands. And so I think, the Supreme Court could easily fix it, right? The Supreme Court reverses horrible decisions all the time. I mean, look at Brown v. Board of Education reversing Plessy. So the Supreme Court could fix this. But at the end of the Supreme Court's decision in Oliphant, if you read the final sentence of that decision, the Supreme Court said, "We recognize the high rates of violence against Native folks on tribal lands, but you know what? Whether or not tribes will be reauthorized to exercise this kind of jurisdiction over non-Indians is a question for Congress, not the courts." And so they punted it back to Congress, which is...
We're going to have to end it there, Mary Catherine sure. Nagel. Thank you very much. She's an attorney with Pipestem Law in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Lisa Brunner co-directs the Indigenous Women's Human Rights Collective in Minnesota. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.